Every year after Thanksgiving and just before Christmas, the world of college football starts to debate heavily about one of the most iconic trophies in all of sport, the Heisman Trophy. Awarded annually to the best college football player in the land, who was the man the trophy is named after? Next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we'll talk about that man, John W. Heisman, and discover why it was named after him, his career, and what he did to deserve such an honor with his great nephew and the man tasked with preserving his legacy, John M. Heisman.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello, and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. I sure hope you've been enjoying the podcast, and thanks for tuning in today. And I hope you've also had a wonderful holiday season. Today, we're going to talk with John Michael Heisman. Many years ago, his father tasked him with an incredible assignment: document the history and preserve the legacy of his great uncle, one of the greatest coaches in the history of college football, John William Heisman. Now, this was not an easy undertaking. In fact, it took years, tons of research, interviews, and a lot of patience. Finally, after all of the information was put together, John wrote a book, Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy. And in just a moment, John will join us to talk about his legendary uncle, what made him so special, the innovations he brought to the game, many of which are still used and in practice today. And he'll also share some terrific stories. First, though, I want to thank all of you who continue to listen to and support Sports Forgotten Heroes. If you'd like to show your support, please visit the Sports Forgotten Heroes Patreon page at patreon.com/sportsfh. That's patreon.com/sportsfh. For as little as $1 a month, your support can go a long way. Follow us on Twitter at SportsFHeroes. Check out our page on Facebook or visit our website, sportsfh.com, to learn more about the guests who appear on the podcast, the great stars we talk about, and to see who else is scheduled to be featured. Today's podcast is sponsored by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. Over 180,000 titles to choose from, including Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy. And these are all for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Audible is a great way to enjoy your favorite books, especially when you're on the run. Give it a try free at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. You get a free Audible book and a 30-day free trial. And it's also another great way to show your support for Sports Forgotten Heroes. So, who was the man behind the trophy, and why did the Downtown Athletic Club of New York City name its College Football Player of the Year trophy after John W. Heisman? Well, without further ado, joining us now on Sports Forgotten Heroes is the great nephew of the man for whom the trophy was named, John M. Heisman. John, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Thank you very much, Warren. I'm happy to be there. I appreciate you having me on.
Let's start here. Tell me about the book that you co-wrote with Mark Schlabach, Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy. Why did you decide to write it?
It was a long developing story. There are several factors to it. One was it was a family obligation that sort of got put in my hands by my father, back in the late early 70s, about the time I was graduating from college. My dad had all of Coach Heisman's memorabilia, and he put it in my hands and said, please do something with this.
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So it took me years to sort through it. Heisman was a prolific writer and collector of information, had a very highly organized mind. But this all came to us in a couple, three old oaken trunks, traveling trunks, that I had to sort through because it was all packed. It was packed with a great deal of care, but it was there was no rhyme or reason to it. And over the years, I assembled it in some sort of chronological order, and then I began working with it. It was about a 40-year project. I actually did try to enlist the help of other writers at several times, asking if they'd like to ghostwrite it. People would look at it and say, I don't think I'm going to tackle this. And so somewhere along the line, I just upped my game and said, I'm going to write it. And I actually wrote probably a 360 or 70 page document.
Wow.
That I revised. I probably had six or seven versions of it. And through a friend of a friend, it got before Simon and Schuster, and we had three different publishing houses under their banner bid on it. And Howard Books came out as the victor. And John Merks, the publisher, said, I'll do this, but I would like a noted sports writer to punch it up. And which kind of injured my pride a little bit, but Mark Schlabel was just the perfect choice to work with, and he and I got along great. He's a fine young man and accomplished professional, and I enjoyed working with him. He and I have become friends in the process, and we still stay in touch.
That's awesome. What surprised you most when you were doing the research? What surprised you most about John Heisman?
Difficult question. My father had told me a whole lot about him growing up. And what amazed me most was just how accurate my father's recollections were. When I got into the written material, I found verification for everything my father ever told me, because my dad can spin a yarn. I thought, okay, he's probably embellishing here or there. But when I got into the material, this was material my dad hadn't seen either and or read. When I got into it, I just found all this historic, written, documented stuff that backed up everything my dad ever told me. I guess that was the most fascinating part for me, but finding out the nuances, the people he knew, the shape of history that happened around him and that he was involved in was fascinating. I think when I started to realize how his career was formed, football may have, there could have been a point in his life had it taken another turn where football would have lost the contributions of Heisman, but Heisman would have been known as a stage name because he owned a theater group. He was an accomplished actor. He made a very good living on stage, much more so than a football coach. But I think he just stuck with his passion, which was athletics and football in specific, and hence his accomplishments in the sport and how he shaped the game went down in history. So there was a point where I thought, you know, he could have gone either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he did end up being pretty accomplished on the stage, and he actually was a very accomplished writer. I mean, every year when talk about the Heisman Trophy heats up and then they award the trophy, what do you think about?
It's sort of a bittersweet time for me because it's a time my dad and I used to connect a lot, especially when I lived in one city and he'd be in another. He would call me up and say, well, what do you think about this guy? And we'd talk about the pros and cons of the selection. We'd talk about you know, maybe if we were surprised or not or whatever. My dad was always coming down on, well, he seems to be a young man of good character, because that was what was so important to Coach Heisman. And when guys started when they started awarding the thing solely based on football performance, my father was very agitated, and I sort of caught that too from him, because I knew what I knew from my readings and all the research I'd done and from the stories my dad told me that character was foremost in Heisman's mind. I had it drilled into me that being a good football player isn't half as important as being a fine gentleman. And that was always what was the mantra of our family.
And some of that came out in the book that way too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very true. It was my dad. My dad lived it. He did not want to see someone get the trophy that was just just crass and would misrepresent the name. And that was always something. So whenever this time of year comes up, there's a bit of angst that goes through me. There's a little bit of, I've been there. I kind of know what goes on. I see how hard the trust works to put on a good presentation and to honor the young players. But it's always the thing where it's been left in the hands of all these voters throughout the country, and I think they get embellished and carried away with all the athleticism they see, and we've sort of gone soft on the character issue.
Interesting. So your book covers a lot, and anybody listening to Sports Forgotten Heroes, I'm going to tell you, get this book, Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy. In fact, you can get it as an Audible book as well. It's just a terrific, terrific read, and it covers so much. So let's talk now about the beginning. John Heisman's father, Michael Heisman. Is it fair to say that Michael Heisman might be responsible for a term we all use today, a barrel of oil, and the measurement of 42 gallons per barrel? Can you tell me about that?
That's a lesser known fact, and it's, I honestly have not been able to find the details of that, other than when he migrated from Cleveland to Titusville because of the oil industry, and when he was trying to save money on shipment, I get the feeling that his standard barrel was already at that gallon mark because of the beer industry. And okay. I think it happened because when he came over on the boat, settled in Cleveland with the other German immigrants, and one of their main staples was having a keg of beer handy, and he made barrels for the beer industry. And I have the feeling that he said, well, this is going to be the standard for the oil industry too.
It's amazing. It still holds true today. Oil, or the manufacturing of the barrels to hold oil, is where the Heisman family actually built their fortune, is it not? I mean, the Heismans also kept good company. Andrew Carnegie, John Rockefeller. What an exciting time. And Pennsylvania is where it all started. In fact, it's where the first barrel of oil was ever pumped. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of the oil industry in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and Michael Heisman, John Heisman's father, his involvement in it?
Yeah. Let me just do a little point of clarification. Michael Cornelius Heisman was my grandfather, Coach Heisman's younger brother, who people in Titusville refer to as Michael, as John Michael Heisman, my great-grandfather, and that's who I'm named for.
Okay.
So I always have to be careful, because when you say Michael, I'm thinking grandfather, and everybody else is thinking my great-grandfather, who was in the oil industry.
Okay.
But it's understandable, because when I go to Titusville, they all call him Michael. It is a pretty phenomenal time. Titusville was, when Drake and company drilled their wells to try to start pumping from the ground, unheard of, very revolutionary. They're just sopping this stuff up off of Oil Creek, in with rags to crudely, in an unprocessed way, one, to get it off the water, two, to just use it to lubricate different things when they could, but they didn't see any practical application for it. And Drake started to understand that if you get this stuff up in mass and get it processed, you'd have something to deal with. And that's when they started to do this. The oil industry sprang up in such a way around Titusville that, you know, millions of dollars flowed, and flowed readily and quickly. They had, when I've gone to Titusville and talked to people and seen the pictures, anybody that had a few bucks to rub together put up a derrick, tried to drill to see if they had any luck. John Michael Heisman himself had a couple of wells, but he found that it was too much of a distraction, that if he concentrated on making barrels, he did much better. When I look at the field where his cooperage stood and where the stockyards were off of the rail spurs, it was, if you can imagine, about a couple of 3 football fields lined up side by side, you can get an idea of how much stock was brought in split wood just to make the barrels on a continual basis and employ anywhere from 30 to 40 men at any given shift that ran all the time. They were just pumping out barrels like crazy. The most interesting thing I found in my research that just floored me, and the summer of 1971, Ed Spence was the editor of the Titusville Herald, and he became friends with my father, and we would go there for different events, and that's how we became retied to the Titusville, to our Titusville roots, so to speak. And I called up Ed and I said, I'd like to get into the archives of the Herald just to read about the time. Could I please do that? And he said, sure. And he put me up at the YMCA downtown. And I had access to the microfiche of the Titusville Herald. And I went in there and I started reading about just the incredible wealth that was spun from the oil industry and the foresight of the Titusville fathers and the industrial giants to invest in this community, both in the arts and in education. In the arts, they actually funded 3 full-stage theaters that brought in talent from all over the world. And their cultural atmosphere in that time, in the late 1800s, was second to none. It was amazing. This is a huge influence in Heisman's life, which is where the thespian bug bit him. The second thing was the educational system was second to none also. The formal education that came to Titusville was of a classical nature. It was tremendous. They brought in the best teachers they could get, and they funded the public schools with a grant, with an endowment. When I was there in 1971, here 100-plus years after the Drake Well, the public schools had never been on a ballot for a millage or a penny from the public till. It was still running on that endowment.
Wow.
I sat there. I went through the high school, and they lacked for nothing. They had everything they could possibly want. Now, the last few years when I've been there, the last time I was there, I think it was 2013. And I asked about it, and they said, yeah, we've had to put a few mills here and there, but it's nothing like what we experience throughout the country when we're trying to raise money to fund our public education. It's just, it would be like, oh yeah, we need this to cover the heating expense this year, something like that. They still have an endowment that supports the floor of that public education in that region. It's amazing.
Incredible.
That thing ran for... and well over a century, so a century and a half.
Wow, that really is incredible. All right, we got to talk football here. John W. Heisman first played the game when it really wasn't similar to what we watch today. Can you tell me a little bit about the game of football when he first played?
Well, if we go back to Titusville, it looked a lot more like a soccer with a built-in rugby scrum. Nobody ran with the ball. It was all kicked. And they piled into each other and just, you know, bashed their shins together until the ball squirted out. And he used to write, he says, since we won all our games, so we must have been a fair bunch of kickers. When he went to Brown, he was looking around. He said, I chose my college poorly when it came to football because they did not have they had just done away with the sport as a club, as a school sport, as a varsity sport, simply because they had embarrassed themselves so badly. So he joined the town club in Providence and played for them. And the thing that when he first got there, there was a pickup game going, and he got in the game and ruined his Titusville suit that he had special tailored to go to college in.
You covered that in depth in the book. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. That's his own writing. It's well done. But he ran with the ball for the first time there, and he says it was the most thrilling thing he could think of. He made about 20 yards picking up a fumble, and somebody brought him down with a bone-jarring crash, and he says it was the happiest thing that had ever happened to him up to that point in his life. But the game was more akin to rugby. It was the red-haired orphan child of rugby, soccer, and a lot of pickup thrown in. It's kind of like if you talk to an Australian, they say we make up our rules as we go along so we can break them as we go along. It's a game that was just mishmashed, and nobody completely agreed with the rules as stated. And the game was a comedy of errors in many ways. The school that had the best talkers and orators and could hold the best arguments often won the game of the rules while they're on the field, while it's being played, while their teammates are moving the hanky that marks where the ball was. It's kind of like that. Formalizing the game came through Walter Camp, through Heisman's writings, through just a number of men who contributed to the rules committee and slowly but surely pressed out the rules over decades of work and time and effort. And Heisman was right at the crux of that. And since he was a prolific writer and had a degree in law, he could set forth a case very, very well and clearly that everybody understood. And much of his suggestions would be written into the rule books almost verbatim as how he proposed. Mm-hmm. So it was a tough game, mass plays, people getting hurt. It was, you know, Teddy Roosevelt stepped in and said, I'm going to prohibit football if you guys don't open this up, clean it up, make it safer. Because the cream of the educational crop in America were dying on the fields.
Interesting. Hey, so you had mentioned Providence and Brown University. Yep. Why did he choose to go to a school that didn't have a football program, that had just canceled their football program, and a school that didn't have a law school, and his father wanted him to study law? Why did he choose Brown?
I think he chose Brown, to answer the second question first, I think he chose Brown to get his core education. It was had a wonderful classicist education going on there. I think that's why he went. As for the football, I don't think he knew that they had abolished or stopped their club. Because he said when he arrived, that's when he found out that they didn't have football, and that's why he joined the town team. I think to pursue law, then that's when he made his, after 2 years, he made his transfer to Penn and went into the law school there.
Yeah, so tell me about his career at Penn and how hard it was for him to make the team especially considering how small he was.
Yeah, it might have been small, but it was mighty with a lot of players. he had to, for the first time, to compete for a position. And Heisman didn't care where he played. He just wanted to play. And he played every position of the line when he was at Penn, starting out at center. And he kept getting stronger and putting on. So he probably increased his weight to a strapping 165, I think. He started out about 150, 155, and he got up to 165. And it was all lean muscle. He was a very fit individual. And he played center, and he had his guards that were on both sides and were 200-plus pound fellas. And so he said he felt very privileged to play next to him, considering he was giving up 40 pounds to each of them. And when they played other teams, he was often the smallest guy there. But his fundamentals were so good that he could hold his own until they all fell on top of him. Then he said it was like being in an earthquake. And he learned to play every position on the line, and he always felt like the linemen were the most valuable players on the team, because they had to understand how to block, when to pull, when to run, when to do this, when to do that. And he said it was the old saying of, to be a lineman you had to be big and dumb, and to be a running back you just had to be dumb. So.
Well, there's something to that about how important line play still is today.
Yeah, it is. And from what I understand, the average IQ of a lineman is quite a bit higher than the average IQ of running backs and receivers. So
interesting.
Yeah, but at Penn, he. Mixed with some of the finest, he teammates with the future mayor of Philadelphia. He was teammates with a gentleman who would be knighted for his work in World War I of keeping the supply lines open. He just knew a whole lot of people who were his contemporaries who would become. Business and international and governmental movers and shakers.
Sure, guys like Dudley Dean, who was the quarterback at Harvard, who went on to become a hero at the Battle of San Juan Hill in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. There was Henry Thornton, who was hired to modernize the Great Britain railway system. Thomas McClung from Yale, who went on to become treasurer of the U.S., under President Taft. I mean, he played with and against some pretty significant people in our history.
Yeah, these were folks that stayed in touch with him, that wrote him, and would go to whenever there was a big game in town in New York or Philly or anywhere else. He could call up and say, "Hey, do you got some tickets?" Or they'd call him and say, "Do you have any tickets?" And they'd all go to the game together. It was pretty phenomenal that he was in the mix of so many influential men. And he ended up, I guess his senior year, he ended up playing end and learning how to block on the end and also tackle from the end position. And he distinguished himself on the Penn team at that time. It was quite something.
Now, his last game at Penn was played at Madison Square Garden, and it's not the same Madison Square Garden that we are all familiar with today, but that game had quite the effect on his career, on his law career, and his coaching career. Can you tell me what happened in that game at Madison Square Garden?
Well, whether this happened before the game or after, I've never been able to verify, but he was shagging balls for the punter, and the custodians of the garden had lowered the big galvanic lights that They used way up to light the interior of the thing. It was quite the modern miracle to light the interior of this vast area, but they did it with galvanic lighting, with arc lighting. And they were testing it, and one of the balls rolled over next to one of these lamps that was now propped against the ground. And he ran over there to get it, and as he bent over, he was facing the lighting, and at that instant, they chose to fire it up, and it would be like looking into an arc welder without any protection.
Mm.
And it did tremendous damage to his eyes. Now, my father was an iron worker, and one of my jobs right out of high school was to go and I was a journeyman iron worker myself, and I've been around welders, and you just don't look at those things without doing damage. You come away with spots in your eyes, and sometimes you get that vision back, and sometimes you don't.
Like looking at the sun, you see this big spot in your eye.
Oh, yeah, exactly. If you're around an arc welder, you never want to look at that white-hot heat there that's generated when that's going on. it's called getting flashed. Well, he was very flashed. This thing went off right in his face. And his eyes blurred up immediately, and everything became blurry, and he couldn't navigate very well. And he thought it would just come back. And they got back to the campus, and a day or two later, he still can't see right, and he cannot. It's impossible to read anything. And here he is, his senior year, and he's in a law program, which requires just an inordinate amount of reading. So what happened was he gathered his friends together, many of which were on the football team, and he said, look, I can't see worth beans. I'm going to need your help. And he formed a study group, and he had them read the lessons to him, and he would argue back the lessons, and then they would interact a lot, and actually improved everybody's grades in the class. It improved their retention, and they all got into the study group habit. And so then he went to the law school board, and he said, by this time everybody knew what had happened, and he petitioned them to take his law finals orally, and to take his exams orally, and they agreed. Now, according to my father, when they agreed, they said, but it'll be harder than what I think everybody else's written exam will be. And he said, okay, I'll just have to deal with it. But my dad said he came out of it flying, he passed with flying colors, and he received his degree.
Yeah, dealt with it, dealt with it really well.
Yes, yes, indeed. Overcame a tremendous hardship in order to do it.
Sure. So after he attended Penn, he went on to coach at a school in Ohio called Oberlin. He only coached there for 1 year, and they went 7-0. But that's where Heisman laid the foundation for his coaching career, and this is also where he established signals. And he came up with quite the intricate system, and he would refine it over time. But the basics were this. Vowels meant the right halfback was getting the ball. Consonants meant the left halfback was getting the ball. A vowel followed by a number under 100, such as A45, meant the right halfback would get the ball, would go straight ahead on his own side through the tackle. Talk about his system. Where did he come up with this? Who called the plays and signals? How difficult were they to comprehend? How did players study for them? I mean, wow.
Yeah, he had a system. He had started out with signals was such a work of evolution. And he talks about when he played the different signals and how there was all kinds of different things they thought were real clever. And if you ended a word with L-Y, you're going right. And if you didn't, you're going left. And all kinds of stuff was happening. It was like, but he became, when you talked to or you read any of the articles of his early years, or you read any of the journals or any of the publications, collegiate newspaper stuff, they always refer to Heisman as having a scientific methodology. And the players had, much as if they were in a classroom, had to memorize his plays. And he did not necessarily have very easy cross-referencing play. I mean, I can remember playing and knowing that the holes were numbered 0, 1 through 9, even numbers left, odd numbers right.
Mm-hmm.
And the backs were numbered 1 through 4. And the 3-back was always the fullback. And if you call it a 36, he was going through off tackle on the left side. That was just such a standard that you just put the two numbers together. You knew who was carrying the ball and where they were going. And then the blind blocked accordingly. But his system was not that simple. It was like he had numbers that corresponded to backs and holes and where they were going and what the contingencies were and what the vowels meant and what the consonants meant. When you called it out, everybody had to know and be on the same page at once. And then he had, later on, he put in the shift, which was a whole nother dimension of attack that was just horrible for a defense to figure out how to defend. And it was a silent signal. Nobody knew how they did it or how they were able to shift at the right time. And finally, an old Georgia Tech player told me how he did it. He says when the center bent over to snap it, it was all one motion. And as soon as he bent over, the shift happened, and then the ball came back, and you had to be in the right place. Well, the signals, my dad once told me that when Heisman set up his signal program with everybody, and if they balked at it, he said, son, where are you? He says, well, I'm standing right here. He says, no, what college do you belong to?
Hmm.
And he would either say Oberlin, Bucktel, Clemson, API, Georgia Tech, whatever it was. And he says, and how did you get here? And he says, well, I studied real hard. And he says, now apply yourself. basically, he'd get the message across, which was, look, you're in college. What percentage of people get into college? You're here because you have brains. If you have brains and you're in college, you can learn my system. And it's that simple. And he never let anyone off the hook. So if you didn't learn his plays, if you didn't learn it the way he said it, you didn't play. And everybody was crazy. They wanted to play, so they learned it.
I could just see them walking around with a playbook, you know, bumping into trees.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, it was... they would quiz each other until they had it. And his best teams would have it down right away. And they would, because if you didn't have it down, he had a way of making you feel about an inch big.
Mm-hmm.
And he would appeal to your common sense and to your intellect and say, you know, how did you ever get into college, young man?
So
he expected a couple of things. One, you be a gentleman. Two, you study because your studies came first. And then three, you play your hardest and work very hard on the football field so that you enjoyed it and you represented your alma mater correctly.
And you refer to that later on in the book too, again, about how important it was to be proper and respectful. So he goes 7-0 at Oberlin, but they can't afford to keep him. So he moves on to Bucktel, which later becomes the University of Akron. He met with some success there, but they didn't play a whole lot over a 2-year period. They went something like 6-2. And then he went back to Oberlin. They needed a coach for the final two games of the year. This is also when one of the biggest and saddest events in his life happened and really shaped the rest of his career. The woman he wanted to marry... And we'll talk about what happened later on in the interview. The woman who he wanted to marry got consumption, which is better known as tuberculosis. She wouldn't marry him, and staying in Ohio would be tough on John mentally. So he packed up and left. It was quite a year for him. All that happened, but in a crude way, it worked out well for him, and he wound up at Auburn. Wow. What can you tell us about 1895 and his failed attempt at growing tomatoes?
quite the year. Staying in Oberlin was going to be too painful. He did not want to eventually attend his fiance's, ex-fiance's funeral. That was more than he could bear. And she literally sent him away. She was a very strong-willed woman.
I will talk a little bit more about her later on.
Yeah. So he just decided he needed a change. And you have to remember that this is a time when if you're in college, you're not assured a job of any kind. You're still not assured a job when you're in college. But at that time, it was like if you had an education, you had something to barter. You were a man of letters. You could go do something. Heisman still wasn't in a position where he could perform the reading duties or just the cursory things you had to do to be an attorney. And he also knew that he was somewhat, sought after as a football coach, but that wasn't widely known. It wasn't like today, football coach gets fired or gets released or finds a better, greener pastures. He has to, figure out what he's going to do for a living. Well, we were still, we're just entering into the Industrial Revolution. I mean, the oil industry started that. But he is looking at, how can I make a buck? So he starts doing what had been popular by a lot of entrepreneurs. He became a gentleman farmer. I know that if you get into the history of the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, that was caused by numerous gentleman farmers growing wheat and depleting the soil and creating the great dust storms and wiping out the topsoil of central Oklahoma. Well, he didn't do that. He went to East Texas. And he, leased a field and he started trying to grow tomatoes, thinking, tomatoes is a good cash crop. Now, unfortunately, he was faced with some very severe heat and drought, and he was about to lose his shirt. Well, along comes a gentleman who had been looking for a football coach, and he was in communication with some folks at Penn, and he says, if you can find John Heisman, we think he went to Texas. you'd have a very good man.
Yeah, small little place at that time.
Right. And he, lo and behold, he tracks him down and meets with him, and the picture I always have of that meeting is he's looking around saying, talking about API, Alabama Polytechnical Institute, which became Auburn, and looking around at these dying tomatoes and saying, we sure do need a football coach. Would you consider it? And he did not once mention the fact that it's obvious you're losing your shirt here. And I think that's what won Heisman over. The man refused to put him in an embarrassing position, and they became lifelong friends. And that's how he got to Auburn.
Interesting.
And I can just picture him taking his hoe and pitching it over his shoulder and walking off the field with him. So
after Heisman's quote-unquote failed attempt at tomato farming, that's when he heads back to coaching college football. And he goes at it full bore. But before we get there, I just want to remind everyone that today's podcast is sponsored by Audible. And for listeners of Sports Forgotten Heroes, we have a terrific offer for you. Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Over 180,000 titles available, from history to fiction to sports and more. Give Audible a try. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/sportsfh. Again, that's audibletrial.com/sportsfh for your free audiobook. Hey, if you're like me and you're running through airports, sitting on planes, racing from location to location, and you just can't find the time to sit down and read, and you don't like lugging around a heavy book, Audible is great. Give it a try. It's free. And the book Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy, is available on Audible. It's a great read or a great listen. So, Heisman turns his back on becoming a farmer in Texas and heads to the Agricultural and Mechanical College of Alabama, which later becomes known as Auburn University. And this is where the legend of John W. Heisman, the man for whom the Heisman Trophy was named, really takes off.
Hey, let's advance the story a little here. He played the game and ultimately became a legendary coach. And he played a huge role in establishing the rules of which we are very familiar with today. He came up with blocking schemes for backs when the rules were changed to allow for blocking. He came up with the term hike. He divided the game into quarters. He conceived of the center snap and much more. Tell me about that. That one's really interesting to me. How did he conceive of the center snap?
That one was because the young man that they recruited for quarterback at Bucktel, Henry Clark, was the pitcher of their baseball team, and they figured that he could do long lateral passes quite easily from that position because he had strong arms. He was 6'2", but all his, it turns out, he said, as Heisman put it, was all his height was in his legs. He was very short trunked. And so back then, the way the play started was much like rugby, which was you heel the ball back or you paw the ball back, one of the two. When I played rugby, and normally it was a heel back. If you pawed it back, it was a violation. But back then, like I said, in the American sport, rules were made to be broken, and you did whatever you wanted to do. So they would start the play by pawing the ball back, and some guys would roll it back such end over end to make it flip up to the quarterback. But seemed that poor Henry had a hard time bending over and fielding the ball cleanly, no matter what they did. So Heisman finally said, well, Ramrod, that was his nickname, Ramrod can't bend over, so just throw the ball up to him between your legs. And so the center bent over, grabbed it, and flipped it up with a quick snap, and came right to the guy's, right to his hands, right about at his waist level, and he says, hey, that's it, that's the stuff. And Heisman actually turned around, they took him at his word, and he looked at it and he went, wow, we could get going a lot faster if we do this. So that's what happened. They only had one team all year long that objected to this. And they kind of played through it. But by next year, everyone countrywide, the state's spread like wildfire. And I think that is probably one of the most significant things that happened to speed up the game and change its character. Just think of all the rules surrounding the center snap and offsides just everything. There's so many, it created the linesman position to make sure that there were no offsides, that there was no illegal procedures, no this, no that. Everything started to surround what was going on with the center and how he hiked it. So that was the big That was a big one. I'm often asked about, well, wouldn't you like a nickel or a dime for every touchdown pass thrown? I always said I'd rather have a penny for every center snap.
That'd be a lot of pennies. There was another.
Yeah.
There was another thing, another revolution that he was very much a part of, and I believe it had to do with Richard Von Gammon, wasn't it? Heisman, who campaigned hard for the forward pass, and it was finally permitted in 1906. What enthralled him so much about the forward pass? What did it have to do with Richard Von Gammon? Who was Richard Von Gammon, and why did Heisman think it would help limit injuries?
He campaigned for it, primarily because, one, we've already mentioned that Teddy Roosevelt had said, unless you clean up the game and reduce injuries, I'm going to abolish football. And in, back in the 1890s, Heisman witnessed a game between North Carolina and Georgia, in which North Carolina just, in desperation, was about to be tackled for a tremendous loss. And one of the guys said, pitch it here. And this guy threw about a 12-yard forward pass to this guy, who grabbed it, hauled it in, went for a touchdown 70 yards down the field. And in the middle of it, the referee had been turned around, because there's only one referee out in the field at this time, and hadn't seen how the ball got there, and he called it a legal touchdown. And Heisman was on the sidelines. He said, it happened not 15 yards in front of me. And he says, at the time, I said, forward pass, just out loud. And he immediately saw the benefits of it, in that, one, it kept from creating these monster collisions with large individuals, because at that time, it was getting more and more, let's get the biggest guys we can possibly get, and it'll just be a smash fest to see where the ball ends up. And he said it just became, you know, it was just these huge collisions, these horrible, crushing tackles that weren't one-on-one. It was like five, six, seven on a few people, and you ended up with broken bones, broken ribs, pierced lungs, all kinds of bad things happened. And when he saw this, it instantly became apparent to him that, one, you can avoid these collisions, and two, it opened the game up for smaller players again. That the guy that might come out for football but wouldn't because of how big these guys were would come out, because it became more finesse. So he immediately started laying the groundwork, especially when Roosevelt got involved in the early 1900s, and he started writing the rules committee, and Camp just sort of wouldn't let it happen. He says, that's changing the game too much. That's barnstorming. That's this, that's that. And finally, when Roosevelt got involved, Camp relented, and they legalized it. And at first, a forward pass could go no farther than 5 yards. Later, it got opened up a bit more. There was a lot of rules that curtailed what you could do with a forward pass. I mean, what they could do then, and what we see now with, you know, 50-yard strikes downfield was just night and day.
Yeah, but and the ball was much different than it is today as well.
Yeah. You'd pick up a blunt-ended ball that looked more like a rugby ball and try to throw it downfield. It'll go, but not nearly as far.
Right. So he, after a few years at Auburn, he jumps to Clemson, and his first season there was quite spectacular. The Tigers went 6-0 and outscored the opposition 222-10. Why was Clemson, and for that matter, all of Heisman's teams, with the exception of maybe the last team he coached, able to dominate so much?
Good question. I think I think one reason is that in the South, Heisman found a lot of fighting spirit, a lot of players that just love to play. I think he found a very fertile ground for the game. The other was, again, this scientific approach that he used to create havoc out on the football field. And I just think that he was light years ahead of everybody around him. He took such an in-depth look at what was going on. He says there are things that we would play 10, 15 years ago that hadn't been used and people forgot about them. So we'd resurrect them and improve upon them, bring them back out and use them, and nobody knew how to stop them. And he felt like the best way to win a game was just simply run the legs off the opposition and just pile up scores. And he loved to pile up scores. So he did it.
Yeah, he sure did.
One of the things he talked about was long lateral passes that let you warp around ends were things that they used when he was playing at Penn. And he says it kind of got dropped in favor of some other things, and people forgot about it. So he resurrected it, especially at Clemson. And then he also had, again, being a guy that had played every position on the line, he always looked for very, very fast guards. He loved the guard position. He felt it was the most important position on the field. And at Clemson, he found two of them that were very fast. And he could do all kinds of things. And he'd pull them out of the line and run one way or the other with them all the time, leading blocking. Because he had memories of a guy from Yale by the name of, or not Yale, but Princeton, by the name of Heffelfinger. And Heff was 212 pounds of steel muscle who... Once he pulled out of the line, came running, he was just looking to see how many people he was going to lay waste every time he ran around. He was fast and he was big. And Heisman took notes on this guy, and he said, if I ever get fast guards, this is the way I'm going to do it. Yeah. So he got a couple of guys sitting, and what's the other guy's name? I'm blanking on it. But these guys could pull out and run interference better than anybody else in the conference. They primarily, more than anything else, just really opened it up for him.
He also liked trick plays. And in regards to trick plays, he once told the Atlanta Constitution, many people have considered tricks an unworthy way of winning games. But I hold that it is the same in war, where all kinds of tricks go by the name of strategy. And I prefer to call my style of playing strategical instead of trickery. Considering his teams were usually physically smaller than those he played against, he used strategy to win. Did he not? After all, football is a strategical game.
He said back in his day, when someone ran a quote-unquote trick play or some sort of means of that, that was sort of a shaded ray, whatever it might be, people admired it rather than criticized it. That it was, they thought it most clever. It's sort of like, oh my gosh, they did the hidden ball trick. Well, back then, if you could do something that was really interesting and fake out the other guy, it was considered a really interesting. It was considered with a much, much appreciation, let's put it that way.
And after all, that's what you were trying to do. You wanted to win the game.
I had a kid, I forget which team it was with, but he would hike the ball. And the quarterback would turn around and fake a pitch, but he didn't have the ball. And the center was still holding the ball up behind his legs. And everybody would run with the play, and he'd pull it back in, go running down the field. Well, today you can't do that unless the ball hits the ground, bounces back up, which is difficult to pull off with the way the ball is shaped today. But back then, unless you were really noticing what was going on, you could get away with something like that, and the center could just pull the ball back in and just walk down the field. that was considered part of his strategy.
He jumped around a lot. He went from college to college to college. We've already talked about Oberlin, Bucknell, Auburn. He coached at Clemson. And then there was Georgia Tech. And they were so tired of losing to him, and they couldn't stand the 73-0 whitewashing of 1903 that they suffered against him, that they set their sights on him. And ultimately, that's where he wound up, Georgia Tech. Why would he leave such a good job at Clemson for a team he destroyed?
Yeah, they got tired of, Georgia Tech got tired of losing. Atlanta was, at that time, a major city, still is a major city. There was opportunities there. It was situated in the county of his wife's family, and she wanted to go back to Georgia Tech.
And that's an interesting family, too.
Oh, it is, the McCulloughs. There was several things going on. One was he was a fellow who paid attention to dollars and cents, and they offered him a salary that wasn't that much more than what he was making at Clemson. He was still doing summer stock when he was at Clemson, his theater, and he was making more money there. He was allowed to continue doing summer stock while he was at Georgia Tech if he wanted to. And he came and he looked at the field and he says, okay, here are my conditions. I want a fence built around the field, and we'll put up a till, and I want 30% of the gate. And the trustee said, we can't afford to put a fence up around here or stands or anything else. He says, I'll get the fence built, you get the stands built. And he pulled in some favors from some people that he knew from the prison system. And the prisoners came over and built the fences around the field. And then he brought in over the years, he had a program with the prison system to teach them football, to give them a proper social outlet for their aggression, the things that put them in the prison. And they used it as a reforming effort. Well, then he also pressed the boosters, and he said, I'm sure you know somebody on the Atlanta Constitution or the Journal or anybody else that they might need a sports byline. He says, I want to be able to write a column for you. And these guys are saying, well, football coach, what can he write about? Sure, we'll do it. And I forget whether he got a nickel a line or a penny a word or something like that. I remember interviewing Chip Roberts, his first quarterback at Georgia Tech. And he was a 93-year-old gentleman at that time, still sharp as a tack. And he said, what they didn't get was that Heisman could write volumes about a toaster. and he did. And he made a good living, he pocketed a lot of money, but the Journal didn't complain because it upped their readership on sports. So he had that going. Every place he went, he just asked, he says, how about this? How about that? And he always got it. And he was able to pocket a lot of money. He was an entrepreneur. There's no getting around it.
Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons he did go there, and you sort of referenced it, and ultimately it's one of the reasons why he left too, was Evelyn McCollum. Tell me about Evelyn, in particular, her father.
Her father was an interesting figure, and this is something that Mark Schlabaugh brought out. That was something I had not had before. Evelyn was... The coach met her on stage. She actually was very smitten by her sister, and who they called Hazel Wood.
Hmm.
But Hazel was at the time betrothed and then married to another man. And so Evelyn just said, look, you're not going to get her, but I'm available. And she was, you know, a beautiful woman in her own right. She also had a son from a first marriage. And that gentleman passed away. And so she was a widow with a young son.
Mm-hmm.
And Heisman said, well, let's go through some courtship and see where this takes us. And they eventually married while he was still at Clemson. And then when the opportunity came to come back to Atlanta, she jumped. I think she was certainly a driving force to do that. Now, her father was a Confederate colonel who had a cavalry, and it was McCullough's Raiders. And when the South surrendered at Appomattox, he refused to surrender. And he was one of these rogue bands that went around punishing Confederates who accepted the surrender, and he was quite a bloody character. He was finally hunted down by a sheriff in a town, and he was actually gunned down at a barber shop, might have been a general store. It's in the book, and it's a lot more accurate than my memory.
What an interesting life.
It was an amazing life, and I guess Evelyn was there when her father died of buckshot, buckshot wounds. But it had to have been quite a traumatic experience for her. She was quite something. She was an actress, a stage performer, and also from what I gather and what reading between the lines, she was quite a strong-willed person.
Mm-hmm.
Heisman was strong-willed also, and they talked frankly about where they're at and what their feelings were and what was going on, and they discussed things quite openly.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, she was not a wallflower in any way, shape, or form, and Heisman obviously was not a shy person either.
Right.
Ultimately, I think his drive and his passions and her passions came into conflict.
Sure. We'll get to that in just a second. I want to go back to the football field for a moment. There's something that really bothered Heisman as a coach, something that he just couldn't stand, and it's something that a lot of coaches today can't stand, the fumble. What did he do to his players when they fumbled the ball?
Well, the treatment for fumbling was 100 throws and catch against the wall. That included the managers if they dropped the ball. He gathered the team together every year before the first practice, and he'd hold out the ball and he'd say, what is this? And woe be it to anyone that tried to answer. You can almost look and see the upperclassmen putting their hands over the mouths of the lowerclassmen so that they don't make idiots of themselves. And he would turn and he would say, this is a piece of leather wrapped around a rubber bladder in a prolated spheroid shape. Costs about $1.25 in any hardware store. It says, better to have died a small boy than to fumble this football. And that's how he started every season. It was sort of a ritual. And then if you fumbled during practice, you went over to the wall and you started bouncing the ball against the wall and catching it, and you'd do it 100 times. And he would assign a manager to count the throws. And every so often he would check back with the manager. He'd say, Mr. So-and-so, how many is that? And he would say 78. And Heisman would say, I count 73. He would know every throw. He would keep track of it in his mind while he would be multitasking and instructing his team. And he couldn't fool him. He just could not pull a wool over his eyes in any way.
Georgia Tech wasn't that good a football team before he got there, as we talked about previously. But he gets there, and they go 8-1-1 in 1904, his first year with the team. He turned the program around so quickly. How'd he do it? Especially with a program that had never really experienced success previously.
I think Heisman was a phenomenon that hadn't hit the college campus circuit except by just a few men. He was focused. He was serious. He had a tremendous means of leadership. He said a football coach has to be a dictator, a performer, the all in all, the general poobah and the magistrate of a football team. His word is law, and nobody can question it. And he brought that type of sharp focus in there so that young men following him instantly respected it. And I think that there's something to be said about that time in the South where he's still appealing to young men whose parents had been in the Confederacy. And I don't know if you ever saw the film Gettysburg. There's a great line that Longstreet says where he says, we in the South love our generals and our preachers. And it's like a good orator goes far in that climate. And I think that he had the ability to capture the imaginations of these young men and lift them to a place they hadn't been before. Al Loeb, who was captain of his 1912 team, he was a Jewish man in the Bible Belt, about to leave school, and Heisman convinced him that he needed to draw upon those same Jewish roots to be a man in the midst of trepidation. And Loeb turned into one of the finest centers he ever had. And Loeb said Heisman had a way of taking minimums and making them maximums. He says, "I know because he did it with me."
And he also fought for the right for an African American later on too.
Yes, yeah. The later at Washington and Jefferson, Jackie Robinson. And long before Ernie Nevers, he championed racial equality with his players against a Southern school.
Mm-hmm.
Well before anybody else was talking about crossing racial barriers and color lines. And here he was taking a very unpopular stance and not backing down.
Right. From 1914 to 1918, Georgia Tech didn't lose a single game. They went 33-0-2. And in 1917, they were named the number one team in the country after thumping, and I mean thumping, Auburn 68-7 to conclude a perfect 9-0 season. They outscored the opposition 491-17. It took him 14 years to climb to the top, but some schools that season didn't field teams because of World War I. Do you think that diminished the accomplishment? How satisfying was it for John Heisman to finally win the national championship, even though some schools didn't field a team?
I think I know that argument, but when I look at some of the team photos that I possess, I see some men in uniform in those team photos that were going off to war. So I think, all in all, it hit across board fairly evenly. There was also another thing going on at that time, which people don't talk about. That was the influenza epidemic that hit everybody. Between the war and the flu epidemic, schools and the nation was decimated. It was just an incredible loss of life back then. And, you know, Atlanta wasn't spared. Georgia Tech wasn't spared. Nobody was spared. Now, the one thing that did happen was General Woods did come to Georgia Tech and say and encouraged many of the students to stay and get their engineering degrees because they would help the war effort with their degrees than without them, because we need engineers.
Hmm.
So many, because it was a technical school, because it was, you know, it was an engineering school, and they took those boys right out of college and put them out there building, you know, makeshift bridges and everything else that they needed. There were a few more that probably stayed, but nonetheless, Georgia Tech added to the war effort just as much as anybody else did. I look at that and I'm saying, well, Auburn fielded a team, Ohio State fielded a team. You know, and Ohio State, Auburn, and Georgia Tech were considered the 1, 2, and 3 teams in the country. Auburn played Ohio State the week before and played them to a tie. And then that's the next week came the thumping by Georgia Tech. So it's not like this was done against severely weakened opponents. I think if there was a lowering of talent, it was across the board.
Hmm. The way he left Georgia Tech was quite unusual. Tell me about that.
Well, there was a number of things going on. One is, I think that, as we mentioned earlier, Evelyn and the coach had been having some frank discussions, and I think they both knew that the marriage had been sliding downhill for quite some time. There is a letter that we have that was found in which Heisman wrote to the Georgia Tech student body. It says, if you happen to be up in New York City at such and such an address, stop in and see your old coach. And that's actually a letter written in 1918, a year before he left.
Hmm.
So it tells me that he had designs to go to New York. That's what he really wanted to do. And I have the feeling that Evelyn did not want to leave Atlanta.
Right.
So we think, as best as we can make out, we think that they were trying to work this through for over, I'm saying for about a year and a half or so. They're trying to work this out. And finally, they just had a very frank discussion and said, you know, you want what you want and I want what I want. And obviously it's not going to happen. So on a Sunday afternoon, he calls Chip Roberts and a few other coaches in there, and he says, gentlemen, you'll find 12 packets of our holdings, of all our physical holdings. Would you go through them and create an equal divide into two piles? And I remember Roberts telling me, he says, we just thought it was another exercise the coach wanted us to do. We just went ahead and got down to it. It took us about 20, 25 minutes. And we put 6 packets together on 2 different piles. And he said they totaled up within a few dollars of each other. And they stopped and they looked up and the coach said, well, as you may have surmised, Mrs. Heisman and I have decided to divorce and
wow.
to avoid social embarrassment, I've agreed to live elsewhere from where she wants to live.
Shocker.
And they turned to her and she says, well, I'm staying here in Atlanta. And as Chip Roberts says, we knew at that moment we had lost our coach.
Wow.
And he said, we went home. He says, I went home and I cried myself to sleep.
Wow.
And it was devastating to these people. They had no clue. Anyway, when the news hit, it went through the football team. It went through everybody, and it was just a shocker. Shockwaves went all the way through Atlanta when he decided to leave.
Yeah.
So he started over, and he
went back to his alma mater. Yeah, he goes back to his alma mater, Penn. But it wasn't easy. In fact, coaching Penn might have been one of the most challenging jobs of his career. But Something amazing happened at Penn. He's conducting a practice, and there's a voice that can be heard at the opposite end of Franklin Field. And this voice is calling out, and it's criticizing the team. And now he's getting upset, and he's going to go confront the voice. This is one of the most amazing stories in the book. It's one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. It's incredible. Tell me about it.
This came through my dad, and he said they were having practice, and he knew that there was some sort of commotion at the other end of the stadium, and he was doing something he couldn't tear away from. Finally, a player ran up, and he says, "Coach, there's somebody down there really kind of heckling us, giving it to us." And he says, "It's getting so that we can't even concentrate on what we're doing." And Ashton says, "I'll see about this." And his dander is up. He's about ready to, you know, lay into whoever this is. And I'm going to blast them with the icy blows of the Northwest. This isn't going to be tolerated. He's on his way over, and you can see the steam coming out of his ears, you know. And he gets over there, and some woman is up in the stands telling him, "You guys can't even whip the women's auxiliary. What are you going to do against Franklin?" Da 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 da. And he turns and he looks up there, and this lady turns on him and says, "What's the matter, Heist? Don't you have it anymore?" And he looks up there and hears Edith standing there in front of him. She hadn't died at all, and she was just as verbose as ever.
So let's just remind everybody, Edith was the woman whom he left Ohio because she was going to pass away because of tuberculosis, and staying in Ohio, John couldn't mentally handle it. So he assumes she's passed on, and he leaves. And how many years later, she's sitting in the stands heckling his team.
Somewhere around 1921, 22, or 20 maybe, I'm not sure. And they're reunited and they marry. And it's just an amazing, sort of amazing turn of events. And she became the football mother to the team. She was totally... She loved football. She loved the passion that Heisman had for the game. She had loved that back in Oberlin. And something I don't think Edith or Evelyn ever shared with Heisman was the love of the game.
Mm-hmm.
She loved all the niceties that came with it, the notoriety around town. But I don't think she really liked the game itself. And here was Edith, who's back in... in a sense, she's back in her element with him. And, you know, the first love is reunited and they're back together again.
One of those Hollywood endings that you would never believe if it didn't really happen.
Yep.
So yep. He coaches at Penn. As I said, it was a challenging time for him. And he moves on to Washington and Jefferson, where he went 6-1-1. Amazingly, for some of the administration, for some people at Washington and Jefferson, that wasn't good enough. And so he resigns. Then he goes down to Rice Institute in Texas, which is now known as Rice University, for a 4-year stint. Those final years were mediocre at best, but he tried everything he could to turn Rice around, including having everyone on the team grow beards. And he was the first to have an all-athletics dormitory. How difficult were those last years for John, and why the beards?
Yeah. Very difficult. It was hard enough when he went back to Penn. I think had he stayed at Washington at Jeff, it would have been a great place to wind up. But I think he was trying to just sock away as much money as he could. He felt like his career was coming to an end, and they offered him a lot of money to go to Rice, and he took it. I think had he stayed at Washington Jefferson, he might have built another dynasty. But Rice was challenging. I had a letter. I have a letter in his that was in his collection of a fellow who was sort of the booster in charge of recruiting. And here it is about a month before the season starts, and Heisman's going to go to Houston and start looking over the material and whipping him into shape. And the guy says, I haven't had time to get out and do much. We haven't really recruited. I've been on vacation, this, that, and the other. And it's very blasé about this. He says, I'll be back in a few weeks, and we'll see if we can whip together some talent for you. He's just taken the job, and time is running short, and no one's been out talking to any kids coming out of school about coming over and playing football for Rice. And the thing is that Rice is known as the Ivy League school of the West at that time, and still is to a great extent. It's got high academic standards, but it also competes with University of Texas, Texas A&M, Texas Christian, some big schools that drain a lot of talent in the Texas state and Oklahoma as well. And so Rice really gets sort of the leftovers and only gets the kids mm-hmm. that can make it academically at a high standard school. So they do not have a lot of football material, and if they get some, they can't surround it with a lot of backing. If they get a good back, they probably have a poor line. If they have a good line, they don't have anybody that can run. It goes on and on and on like that. So he gets an all. He puts together this dormitory because he wants all the team to get together and create and start working as a unit. And he figures if he gets them into a dormitory where they can supervise curfews and also build camaraderie, they might stand a better chance. And he can also control their diets as well. And that was a big thing for him, was to control the diets of the players.
So those last couple of years at Rice were quite disappointing. You know, there's so much more that we can cover. We didn't talk about baseball. We didn't talk about gymnastics. We touched upon the Heisman shift. We really haven't talked about much of his stage presence, his writing. There's so much more. I encourage everyone listening to Sports Forgotten Heroes to get a copy of Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy. It is such a great book, very detailed, but not overly long. It's really well written. Kudos to you. And we've got to end it here. After Rice, he goes up to New York City, Downtown Athletic Club. They want to award a trophy to the best college football player of the year after each season. He was not really in agreement with doing that. Why not? And how did they come about the trophy? And then why was it named the John W. Heisman Memorial Trophy?
Well, Heisman is hired in 1930 at the newly built Downtown Athletic Club of New York City. He was sought after as a well-known name, somewhat of a celebrity, an authority of athletics and football in particular. In doing so, they created a draw for membership because this was going to be an exclusive club. It was built by the shipping industry primarily. And it was also a draw for businessmen off of Wall Street and in lower Manhattan. And that, the Downtown Athletic Club stood not so far from Battery Park on South Manhattan. And it's a beautiful facility, had an Olympic-sized swimming pool, had a fight match, a boxing ring, had a squash courts, all kinds of stuff, had a wonderful restaurant.
Sounds like a wonderful place.
It was just a very exclusive club. Heisman was the sitting Yeah, I was there while it was still operating. And unfortunately, after 9/11, it was structurally hampered, and it had to close its doors as a club. It was reestablished as a condominium, and the people, there were tenants in it who bought the place and was able to restore it as a place to live. So I was glad to see the building be maintained. But now Heisman's here, and he is creating tennis matches and tournaments, and he's creating boxing matchings and fight night on Fridays and golf outings in the suburbs and for the members, and golf tournaments and all kinds of things. He's going around, he's doing all these things. He's writing in the club newsletter. He created the Touchdown Club for former college football players. He's doing a lot of stuff. He's just cranking out one event after another. And the board comes to him and says, we want to give out an award to the outstanding player east of the Mississippi in college football every year. And we want to start it this year, and we want you to formalize this and create an awards banquet. And Heisman goes, one, we don't need another banquet. Two, this is the consummate team sport. We don't want to ferret out individuals and give them a big head. This goes against the grain of everything that I ever taught in my teams. And they kept going. They said, well, this would be a tribute to the whole team if one of their players was called the outstanding player. And he goes, no, no, no. And they argued and argued. And they finally said, look, we're the ones that sign your paycheck. This is what we want. This is what we're going to get. And you're going to create the award, and you're going to create the criteria for the award. And he looked over, and one of the guys on the board was a fellow by the name of Jack Prince, who was a good friend. And he said, Jack, you're in this with me. I'm not doing it by myself. And Prince relented and said, okay. And it was Jack that came up with the idea of having a vote. That would, and Heisman said, well, the only qualified people would be sports writers and people that have eyes on the game and see it. And they came up with a means of doing that. And you got your vote by being invited by the DAC to have your vote. So they put it together, and the first player was Jay Berwanger from University of Chicago, the one-man gang. And man in the iron mask, of the many things that they called him. And Heisman approved of him. He was a man that took his studies seriously, and he played the game in a very hard-nosed way. And he instantly liked the guy. And they gave him the Downtown Athletic Club Award in 1935. So they've established their precedent. They have the trophy design. They have all this stuff out there. The little statuette with the stiff arm. And Heisman goes out, and he goes about his business. And he says, okay, maybe they'll lose interest in this, and we can get away with it. And, a year or two from now, they'll let it die. So he goes out in late September. He's out on the golf course with some friends, and he kind of starts to cough and catches cold while he's out there. And he, being a Spartan kind of trainer and athlete, he goes in and takes a cold shower, which was the worst thing he could have done. And the thing just worsened, and he went into pneumonia, and after 9 days, he succumbed to pneumonia, and he passed away. The bad part about this is that penicillin was developed and marketed only within 4 or 5 months after his passing. Probably could have saved his life. So anyway, the board comes together after his passing, and they vote immediately and unanimously to rename the Downtown Athletic Club Award the Heisman Memorial Trophy, and that's how it got its name. And they refitted the DAC award that Berwanger got with the Heisman Memorial Trophy as well. So the thing that he protested against became his memorial.
80 years later, it's still there. John, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time out of your day to spend it with me and talk about your great uncle, John W. Heisman, and the Heisman Trophy. This has been awesome. And like I said, it's a terrific book. I hope all of our listeners pick up a copy. Anything else you want to say about your great uncle?
Oh, it's been a since 1912, I've had a great weight taken off my shoulders by getting the book out there. I feel like I finally did my service to my family. We are working on a film.
Terrific.
To come out. We don't know when. It's Hollywood does drag its heels getting these things done. It's been a working process for several years now, but we're hoping sometime soon before I expire that it'll come out. So anyway, we have that in the works, and we have other things we're trying to promote as well coming up. I hate to talk too much about it because it's still works in process. But it's been good. I feel like we've done right by him, and that now there's something out there that reflects who the man was rather than just a statuette.
Awesome. Once again, John, thank you so much for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure being on. Thanks, Warren.
Heisman wound up coaching for 36 years. He coached at Oberlin for 1 year and compiled a record of 7-0. Then he moved on to Buckle, where he coached for 2 years and went 6-2 before heading back to Oberlin for a brief stay and compiling a mark of 4 wins, 3 losses, and 1 tie. Next up, Auburn, where he spent 5 years and went 12-4-2. Clemson was next, and that's where Heisman compiled a record of 19 wins, 3 losses, and 2 ties over the course of 4 years. Following Clemson, he went on to Georgia Tech for 16 years. While there, he won 102 games and a national championship while only losing 29 games and tying 7. His 3 years at Penn saw him go 16-10-2, and in his lone year at Washington and Jefferson, he went 6-1, and then he finished up at Rice going 14-18-3 over 4 years for the Owls. Overall, John W. Heisman compiled a final record of 186 wins, 70 losses, and 18 ties to go along with 1 national championship. But it's his overall contributions to the game of football that matter most. The center snap, signal calling, developing a playbook, the legalization of the forward pass, the Heisman shift, even the establishment of dormitories for athletes only. Those are just some of the great gifts that John W. Heisman gave and left us. And let's not forget that he expected all of his players to be accountable for their own actions, not curse, and to treat others with the utmost respect, no matter the color of their skin, religious preference, or from where they came. And he lived that life too. For sure, a trophy every year to honor the best college football player in the country is just a small way to pay gratitude. And if you want to learn more about John W. Heisman and what he meant to the game, you can listen to a free download of the book, Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy, on Audible. Just enter the code audibletrial.com/sportsfh. You can order the book on Amazon, or if you'd like an autographed copy of Heisman, The Man Behind the Trophy, there are a limited number available. Please contact me by visiting sportsfh.com. Hit the contact button and send me a note, and I'll let you know how you can get an autographed copy of this terrific book. It's really a great book to read, and it will make a welcome addition to any library. Coming up next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we have a very special guest, the last quarterback to lead the Cleveland Browns to an NFL championship. Yeah, once upon a time, the Browns were, without question, year in and year out, the best team in all of football. And the last quarterback to lead the Browns to an NFL championship was Frank Ryan, a man whom Bleacher Report calls the most underrated player in the history of the NFL. And he'll be here along with Roger Gordon, a terrific author, to talk about Frank and the 1964 Cleveland Browns. That's next time. Thanks again to today's guest, John M. Heisman, and we'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.